You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Eurythmy Therapy. 8 lectures. Collected Works, Volume 315, translated by Alan Stott. This is Lecture 7. Given in Dornach on the 18th of April, 1921, held before physicians. What I have to say in relation to eurythmy, my respected friends, with regard to particulars, you will find it necessary to elucidate what I have to tell you today about eurythmy through your knowledge of physiology and so on. How that can be done will reveal itself as if of its own accord, if I may say so. When we look into a spiritual corporeal process, such as that which takes place in eurythmy, we can do no other than indicate the deeper spiritual physical context. So I would like to draw your attention to the following. First, we must contemplate the extra-human world process, which one usually traces only in its details, and not in regard to what is actually inwardly active. Just consider what earth formation is in reality. A formative tendency works inward from the planetary sphere. Furthermore, a formative working into the earth takes place from what lies beyond the planetary sphere, continuous, radiant cosmic forces, expressing themselves in powerful entities, radiating toward the earth. In this context, we may conceive of these cosmic powers as working toward the center, building up from without that which is on and in the earth, although they could encompass as well all that I have said earlier about such raying. We could conceive them like this. The fact is that, for example, the whole metallic part of the earth, the entire metals, are not in essence formed out of some force or other within the earth, but are actually set into the earth out of the cosmos. Now these forces that work through the ether can be called formative forces working in from outside. They do not work from the planets, for in that case they would work from a center. The planets are there, that is, the planetary sphere, for the specific purpose of modifying these forces. Please take note of them in precisely this context of the formative forces. In opposition to them stand those forces in the human being and in the earth, which take up those formative forces, consolidating them. They assemble them around a point so that the earth can come into being. We may call those forces which consolidate the consolidating forces. In the human being, they are present as the forces that plastically build up the organs, whereas the other forces, the formative forces, have more to do with propelling the organs out of the spiritual etheric world into the physical world. That is a process which becomes so tangible in the contrast between the propulsive powers of magnesium and the rounding-off forces of fluorine. It is a process active everywhere in the teeth, from below upward and rounding off at the top, but from front to back as well, and from the back forward, from above to below, rounding off down below. This process will become directly tangible, as I'd like to say again, if you picture to yourself that in association with the tendency to push something spherical forward, from without inward, something is formed which is opposed by a process of spherical formation from below upward, and there's a sketch. Between these two processes is that which mediates. On the one hand, processes of secretion, and on the other hand, the absorption of other secretions, and so on, which can be called processes of secretion in the widest sense. In the final analysis, absorption is dependent upon a secretion inward, which is in turn reabsorbed. In between lies what can best be called excretory processes. Such an excretory process becomes once again tangible when you picture to yourself, on the one side, what continually wants to excrete carbon, and there's a drawing, and what takes it up through respiration from the front in the formation of carbon dioxide. Behind this, such a process of excretion is continuing. When you descend further into the system of the metabolism and the limbs, you have a proper process of consolidating. However, this process is present in the other direction as well. You will be able to follow it most tangibly by studying the eye, EYE, which is built inward from without, as embryology demonstrates, but is consolidated from within. The formation is internalized. That is the manner in which the eye develops. It is internalized. And there's a drawing. As we progress to that which is of soul and spirit in man, to the organs of the soul and spirit, to the sense organs, we find that the process of consolidation has become spiritualized, truly ensouled and spiritualized in perception. That is more or less the descending process which leads to the formation of the organs. We find at the lowermost end the process of sensory perception, perception of objects. If this development continues, goes further in this direction, then the process of perception encounters the consolidating forces. Should it become conscious in this encounter, it will become imagination. If imagination develops further and becomes conscious in encountering the process of secretion, it becomes inspiration. And when inspiration develops further in the direction of the formative forces, collides with them consciously and so comprehends them, it becomes intuition. One can develop this progression in the life of the soul stage by stage, from perception of sensory objects to imagination to inspiration and to intuition. There's a small little chart here. Intuition, formative forces. Inspiration, secretion processes. Imagination, consolidation. Perception. This process unfolding in the soul, however, is based on the process of coming into being. As you can see here, it is but the inverse of this process of becoming. You encounter what has become, rising into this becoming in the opposite direction. Formation takes place in the descending direction. The human being ascends in the opposite direction. He advances to meet what is coming into being. What one develops as powers of perception and cognition in imagination, inspiration, and intuition always has its counteractivity in the creative powers, in the creative powers which express themselves in the formative forces, in the processes of secretion and of consolidation. From all of this you will gather that what is active in the human organism in the opposite direction, in its coming into being, is that into which one ascends when rising in knowledge. You will perceive that in reality what we attain in imagination are the same powers which, without our being conscious of them, reveal themselves in the phenomena of growth, in the plastic phenomena of growth. If we ascend to inspiration, we come upon the forces which inspire man from without inward in his breathing, which shape him through and through as he breathes, which shape themselves into the plastic forces as they work through these forces to a degree. And if we ascend to intuition, we rise in reality to the primal mover, who enters into our plastic forms from the world without as substantial being. You see, In this way, we grasp the human being as he takes shape out of the cosmos. If we apply the knowledge we have gained in one way or another, through anatomy or physiology, and illuminate it with what is given us here, then we begin to understand the organs and their functions. This is an indication of how to understand the organs and their functions. So, in that which is always at work plastically on the human being, what normally permeates plastically through and through the human being, here yesterday's lecture will be a help, lives, on the other hand, in the movements for the consonants, the unconscious imaginative forces which call forth a streaming through of the organism, as I said yesterday. Here you can perceive how consonantal eurythmy takes hold of deficient formative forces, deficient plastic forces in the human being, transforming them into something truly sculptural. Let us assume we have a child and we see that the plasticity is deficient, that plasticity is proliferating too strongly. What does it mean when we say that plasticity is growing without control? It means that the plasticity is working centrifugally, thus making the head large, because it is working centrifugally, and in doing so is no longer permitting the head to be permeated in the proper manner with imaginative forces. These must be supplied. So one will let the child do consonantal eurythmy. There's a question. A 2-year-old boy has a large head, is nevertheless not hydrocephalic, and is otherwise apparently healthy. Rudolf Steiner. Here you have the effective antidote, improperly applied consonantal eurythmy. Here we have arrived at the point of which a thorough observation of the morphology, of the more profound morphological facts, can provide a direct indication for the eurythmical treatment. There's another question. A boy, 12 3/4 years of age, whose growth in height is distinctly retarded, with no organic findings other than worms, intelligent but intellectually quickly tired. Rudolf Steiner. A most interesting complex of symptoms, all of which indicate that the imaginative forces are insufficient, that the plastic forces in the organs are proliferating because of a lack of inner plastic forces, of plastic soul forces. These plastic forces of the soul are those which destroy parasites. It is no wonder that when these forces are insufficient, the child has worms. Bracket, there is a gap in the stenograph, close bracket. Thus one should have him do consonantal eurythmy. Therein lies the antidote. These associations will provide you with concrete indications of where you can employ eurythmy. Although the phenomena are somewhat camouflaged here, eurythmy will have an extraordinarily positive effect even in such cases, particularly if one complements it medicinally. Here I have an interesting question that has been presented to me. Naturally, I must answer the questions in principle. If complications of any sort should appear, they can later be taken into special consideration as the case demands. However, although it may be necessary to combine something else along with it, the matter has nevertheless been thoroughly dealt with from the side characterized. Question. I have as a patient a 5-year-old child who lost a great deal of blood as the result of a bullet wound suffered in the outbreaks of violence. 2 years ago, a deformation of the joints set in. Bracket, there is a gap in the stenograph. Close bracket, it continues. These are things which could lead to anemia and similar conditions in adults. How could one help this child therapeutically? Rudolf Steiner. Here you have a deformation of the joints. That is an outwardly working tendency of plastic forces that are unable to remain within. So these forces ray outward, leaving the human being instead of working within him as they should. They will be reflected in the most effective manner precisely through the practice of consonantal eurythmy. In doing consonantal eurythmy, you will call forth the objectively effective imaginations that offset the deformations. As the manner in which the question is placed quite correctly indicates, people in the future will in general tend to be deformed in the most manifold ways, because they will no longer be able to build up the normalizing human form out of the involuntarily active forces. Man will become free. He will gradually become free even in respect to the building up of his own form. However, he must then be able to do something with this freedom. He must go on to engender imaginations that continuously counter the deformation. Now, as to the other case, you see that we are here concerned with a dearth of objective imagination. We could have to do with the deficiency of objective inspiration as well, which would express itself in a deformation of the rhythmic system, if I may call it that. In the case of a deformation of the rhythmic system, the objective inspiration which goes inward does not encounter the circulatory rhythm in the proper manner. One can work toward normalizing the situation by practicing vowels in eurythmy. In eurythmy, the vowels affect internal irregularities which are precisely not accompanied by morphological changes, even as consonantal eurythmy affects deformations and the tendency to deformation. As I said earlier, it may nevertheless be necessary to render aid when something appears in particularly radical form, as in the case of the deformations of the joints that we just discussed. There it would be necessary to come to the assistance of the consonantal eurythmical process therapeutically. This consonantal process works by stimulating, through its imagination, the inner breathing of the organs oriented from without inward, and lying on the far side of the intestinal wall, the lungs, the kidneys, the liver, and so on. When a person does consonantal eurythmy, it is a fact that particularly the back of the head, the lungs, the liver, and the kidneys begin to sparkle and flash. Something is really there that indicates the reaction of the spirit and soul to what is done outside in the consonants. The whole human being becomes a shining being in these organs, and the movements that are carried out are in continuous opposition to the luminous movements within. And in particular, there appears, I would like to say, an entire luminous reproduction of the secretory process of the kidneys through certain consonantal movements. One has a picture of the secretory process of the kidneys in this luminous process, which comes about as the result of consonantal eurythmy. That works over into the unconscious imaginations. And the whole process in which this part begins to shine is the same process that I described as being especially under the influence of copper. It is the same process. Here, one must draw the attention of the physicians to the fact that there are people with particular forms of illness. These forms of illness were again brought to my attention yesterday when I was shown some painted pictures, very much admired in some quarters at least, and was asked whether they were particularly occult. In a certain sense, of course, they are occult, but it is extraordinarily difficult to speak to people about these things, for they are an objectively fixed kidney efflorescence. They are the objectively fixed process of the excretion of urine. When, in the case of persons predisposed to this illness, the process of urinary excretion becomes an abnormal, luminous process, that is, when the process of excretion halts, a purely metabolic illness, the kidneys then begin to shine. When this inwardly directed clairvoyance then sets in, people begin to draw wildly. What they produce will be aesthetic, in an outer, formal manner, beautiful in every case. The colors applied will be beautiful. But, of course, people are not content when one says to them, quote, "Yes, there you have painted something very beautiful. It is, in fact, your congested urinary secretion," close quote. I can assure you that congested urinary secretion and suppressed sexual desires, which lead as well in a certain way to metabolic irregularities, are often presented by people of particularly mystical nature as mystically profound drawings and paintings. In much of what makes its appearance in the world in this manner, one should recognize the symptoms of pathological abnormalities in the human being that are still just bearable. As you see, anthroposophically oriented spiritual science is not mysticism, as mysticism is commonly understood, since it fosters no illusions about matters such as we have just characterized. Quite the contrary, it investigates just such matters. People, however, take exception to one for doing this. They resent my having gone so far in a public lecture as to indicate that the lovely poetry, for example, of Mechthild von Magdeburg and of St. Teresa, are the inspirational reflexes of processes arising from repressed sexuality. Here, of course, things are not drawn or painted, but poetically expressed. Naturally, it is not pleasant for people to hear Mechthild von Magdeburg or St. Teresa described as personalities with a strong sexuality, which they restrained precisely because it was too strong for them, that certain metabolic circulatory processes resulted from this retention, and that the reactions to this, in turn, appeared in such a form that they were fixed in very beautiful poetry. Indeed, this phenomenon leads extraordinarily deep into the mysteries of existence, when considered in a higher light. However, one must be able to rise to such an interpretation. Consequently, one must have at least a notion of these peculiar processes which light up as inward processes when eurythmy is done outwardly. And in the moment when what is concealed within the poetry becomes eurythmy, as I showed you yesterday, when a beautiful poem is read and the eurythmy corresponding to it is done, as we saw yesterday in vowels or consonants, then the one thing crosses the other. An inward, silent speaking joins what is carried out outwardly in movements, in the person doing eurythmy as well. When this process does not exude in sultry poetry, but takes instead the course of accompanying beautiful poetry as eurythmy, then that which takes place in the human being does not become a recording of mysticism, but a definite process of healing for the human being. One can say that when one lets the patients do eurythmy in such a manner, that one continually brings to his attention, quote, listen carefully, bring intensely into consciousness the sound that you hear, the relationships of the sentence you hear, to which you are doing eurythmy, close quote, then one will initiate his assent to the outward formative forces, to the objectively intuiting powers. When one wants to affect all that has remained in the human being from what no longer took place between birth and death, but what materialism calls heredity, the greater part of which, however, is carried over from the pre-existent spiritual soul life, if one wants to affect what can be called congenital defects and so on, then one will do well to work, particularly during the course of youth, repeatedly through eurythmy by challenging the person doing it. Quote, make very clear to yourself what you hear outwardly, close quote. By this method, one can drive out all the tendencies to fix inwardly what would like to arise and take form in something like mystical poetry or mystical drawing. Precisely that will be connected to the beautiful outer poem. It is the reverse process. A true mystic knows that what of an abnormal nature is reflected by the human being as beauty always has a questionable side. By contrast, one cannot claim that when what is beautiful in the outer world is experienced inwardly, it appears as a particularly magnificent and beautiful picture. On the contrary, it becomes schematic and thereby abstract. Abstract as if it were sketched. Abstract as a drawing is abstract. That is precisely what is healthy, however, and what is desired. The beautiful historic process would not have taken place, but if, for example, Mechthild von Magdeburg had been instigated to do eurythmy, to good poetry, her entire mystic fate would have been spared her. Naturally, one can say here that a point has been reached where, in a certain sense, good and evil cease to exist. One enters into the amoral sphere of Nietzsche's title Beyond Good and Evil. Of course, one cannot be so philistine as to claim that all the Mechtilts von Magdeburg should be eradicated roots and branch. On the other hand, when people attempt to prevent this tendency from undue proliferation, you may be certain that from the supersensory worlds care will be taken that the corresponding connections with these supersensory worlds nevertheless remain. Although it is quite late, I would still like to go into a few matters in order perhaps to bring some clarification. I would like to start with the following question. Couldn't the therapeutic eurythmy exercises be reinforced by rational breathing exercises? It needn't necessarily be hatha yoga. To this I would like to make the following remarks. In our times and within the direction that the continually progressing human nature has taken, rational breathing exercises, as a reinforcement of the eurythmical exercises, can in fact only be treated in the following manner. It will be observed that a tendency toward a modification in the rhythm of respiration arises of its own accord under the influence of the vowels in eurythmy. One will notice this quite clearly. Here we find ourselves in the uncomfortable situation that we should avoid stereotyping, avoid saying the one thing or another in general, but should first observe what is to be done. Concern yourself in each individual case with the breathing of the person in whose healing you are attempting to be of assistance by means of eurythmical vowel exercises. Observe the modification of the breathing and subsequently make the patient aware that he can consciously pursue this tendency himself. We are no longer human beings like the ancient Orientals, who would go the reverse route and influence the entire human being by way of a prescribed method of breathing. This is something which today leads of necessity, in every case, to inner shocks. No matter how it is prescribed, it should really be avoided. We just have to learn to notice what kind of effect eurythmy itself, especially the vowels in eurythmy, has on the breathing process. And then we can consciously continue the tendency that arises eurythmically in the individual case. You will certainly observe that this respiratory process will be carried on individually, continued in varying manners in different people. My esteemed friends, those are more or less the things that it is possible to answer at the moment. We have no real possibility of dealing with a number of matters that have got bogged down due to the shortness of time. In closing, my dear friends, I want to warn you that you must be prepared that your medical colleagues in the world will wage their wars no less intensely when they become aware of your bringing something of our sort to bear. You will need the penetrating power of conviction to weaken what will confront you. In no case, of course, may what you are confronted with lead you to neglect these matters. We may permit ourselves no illusions about those antagonistic forces we arouse. At the end of this lecture course, I would as well like to state that in order to make the movement possible, as it should now be inaugurated in the medical field, I will adhere everywhere to the policy of not involving myself directly with the patients in the therapeutic process, but will discuss and consult only with the physicians themselves. You will always be in the position to refute any allegations that I myself interfere in any way, in an unjustified manner, in the therapy. I have already mentioned this at the end of the previous lecture course. This has been made extraordinarily difficult for me, even from the anthroposophical side. This cannot be passed over in silence, as people naturally make all possible demands in this direction. It is also definitely the case that among anthroposophists, the tendency exists not only not to rise above egoism, but sometimes to become even more egoistic than normal people are. Then, when the occasion arises, it is often a matter of complete indifference to the person what the welfare of the movement may entail. That is, the welfare of the movement is dependent in each individual instance upon a rejection of the practice of what the world outside terms quackery. That a healing process should take place in the whole of medicine, and should not be disturbed by the demands arising from an individual's personal aspirations. People will make it difficult, but it must be carried through in this direction, since we will only be able to succeed in this area when we can stand up to the outer world, as we are otherwise able to in the anthroposophical movement, insofar as matters are conducted with understanding and not bowdlerized by people without understanding. Simply by virtue of knowing what is going on in the anthroposophical movement, we must be in the position to say, quote, what is being said there in the outer world is certainly a lie. It is beyond doubt an invention, close quote. We must simply always be in the position to say that in certain cases. We come to be able to say that when we are all inwardly initiated into the contents of matters such as those to which I have drawn attention here, that I myself do not intervene in the therapeutic process, but that within the anthroposophical movement the doctors are responsible for the therapy of the patients. Having said that was necessary, I want to add nothing more than the wish that the stimuli, which in this lecture course in particular have often remained mere indications, may work on in you and become active in the appropriate manner for the welfare of humanity. Hopefully, we will have the opportunity to carry on in some manner what we have already twice begun. In any case, we will make an effort to carry on with it. With this wish, my dear friends, I will close these contemplations, in the hope that our deeds in these directions may be in accord with our wishes. It was very satisfying to see you here. It will be a satisfying feeling to think back on these days here, which it was your desire to spend together toward the enrichment of medical science. The thoughts that hold us together will accompany you, my dear friends, on the paths that you will tread, to transform into deeds what we attempted to activate initially here as thoughts. That's the end of the lecture. Words of appreciation were expressed at the end of the lecture course by Professor Doctor of Medicine, etc., Doctor of Medicine Dent Oscar Römer. End of Lecture 7.